Good morning. May it please the court, Attorney Lucas Castor on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Wingate, who's seated in the back of the courtroom. There are a number of sub-issues before the court on this appeal today, but fundamentally really only one question. And that question is, what was in the minds of the decision makers when they decided to deny Mr. Wingate 9 separate promotions over the span of 5 years? More specifically, the question is whether a reasonable juror could conclude when viewing all of the evidence in whole and in favor of Mr. Wingate that his repeated protected complaints against Sergeant DeSubiana at least played some role in the decisions not to promote him. In deciding against Mr. Wingate, the district court committed 2 fundamental legal issues that warrant reversal. Number one, the court failed to view the evidence in favor of Mr. Wingate, as is required on summary judgment. And 2, the court used the incorrect standard regarding pretext. I want to address the first argument first and briefly. We don't have to guess here whether the court failed to view the evidence in Mr. Wingate's favor, because in fact, the district court specifically says it. On page 21 of the order, the court writes, at this stage in the McDonnell-Douglas analysis, the court need not view the evidence in the light most favorable to Wingate. In support, the court cites the 2001 Supreme Court decision, Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Hoover. But upon review of the Hoover decision, that decision says nothing about failing to not view the evidence in Mr. Wingate's favor or in favor of the non-moving party. There's no support for that contention. That stands in direct contradiction to decades-long precedent that upon summary judgment, all of the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. Now I want to move to the second question about pretext. And there's 2 issues with respect to pretext regarding the court's decision. One, the court used the improper standard regarding pretext. The court said in its decision that to prove pretext, the plaintiff must establish that, one, not only is the rationale from the defendant false, but also prove, in addition to that, that a improper motive more likely than not motivated the decision. That contention that you have to, that it's required to prove both, is the incorrect standard. The Pye decision in the Eighth Circuit, the Hoover decision in the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Hicks and Reeves cases, the U.S. Supreme Court specifically say, yes, one of the ways you can raise an inference of pretext is to prove that the rationale provided by the defendant has no basis in fact or is in fact false or unworthy of credence. It is not required to do so. The question at summary judgment is whether a reasonable juror could find at the issue of pretext whether an improper motive more than likely motivated the decision. Yes, you can do that by proving that and this is what the Hicks court says, that you don't have to prove anything above in certain cases, not always, but if you prove that the rationale provided by the defendant is false, along with a prima facie case, that can be enough. It won't always be enough, but it can be. But here, there's evidence of both that their rationale is false or has no basis in fact, and that an improper motive more likely than not motivated decision. So let's turn to that issue, and let's talk about what their rationale is. They provided generally 3 rationale for the decision. That Mr. Wingate is too black and white without a sufficient grasp of the big picture role of a manager within the APD. That he has a constant need for affirmation. And that he's a good officer, but not a good supervisor. And he didn't grow those under him. So let's talk about why that rationale has no basis in fact and thereby not worthy of credence. Number one, every year, Mr. Wingate is given an annual performance review. There is nothing in any of the reviews regarding those 3 rationale, save one comment from 2007, in which one of his supervisors talks about Mr. Wingate being black and white. So, defendant wants to talk about, or respondent wants to talk about temporal proximity. Let's talk about temporal proximity. There's one comment from 2007 5 years before the first adverse promotion decision and 10 years before the last, and they're going to contend that that somehow justified their decision? That can't be. In all of the reviews after 2007, there's no evidence of any of their stated rationale. Zero.
In those reviews, was he a supervisor at that time?
He wasn't a supervisor. He did have a supervisory role, and this is going to my second point. At different times, he did hold a supervisory role in the sense of being an FTO, which is essentially responsible for training and advising the newest of the new officers. When a new officer comes on, the field training officer or that supervisor is responsible for going out and observing them and correcting them when they're wrong. So,
But you're trying to say, one of their reasons is he's not a good supervisor. And you're saying, well, if you look at his performance reviews, no one ever mentioned that. Well, if he was never a supervisor, they wouldn't say whether he was a good or a bad supervisor. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, in the sense that he didn't hold a official supervisory role in the sense of having constant people underneath him, but he did hold an FTO position where he was supervising people. And the question is, could a reasonable juror infer that he did have some supervisory responsibility and he was good at it? Respondent gives him an FTO position where he's supposedly supposed to train the
FTO
newest of the new officers.
FTO stands for field training officer?
I'm sorry?
Does FTO stand for field training officer?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And so if Mr. Wingate wasn't a good supervisor, wasn't a good trainer, didn't do well taking care of people, why would they put him in charge of the newest of the new officers?
And in one of his performance reviews, didn't it mention that he teaches others well?
That's exactly right. That was my next point. His reviews talk about him being team-oriented, about motivating other people. There's a specific reference to teaching other people well. So the documented evidence establishes that Mr. Wingate not only served in some sort of supervisory role, but also did that well. The third point I want to make about the supervisory issue is the testing that they created for the promotion decisions between 2012 and 2017 was specifically designed to test the applicant's abilities in these supervisory roles. It's not a testing that's used for non-supervisory positions. It's specifically designed for this position. And so the fact that Mr. Wingate scored in the top three separate times and in the top six every time is evidence that he was could be a good supervisor based on their own testing.
Can you point me to where in the record I can find the criteria that were used in the initial phase, the testing?
For which promotion? Because there are several different promotions.
For any of them. I know he, in the 2017 promotional process, he scored as the top candidate, and I'm wondering what criteria was used in the first phase.
How does
that relate to the concerns that were raised by the MAC?
Well, there's a list of testing protocols that are provided. I'm sorry, I don't have in the specific reference to the test scores from the record. But each score is listed out based on that protocol, and that differs based on the different testing years that are provided.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is in the first phase, what criteria was applied to determine the scoring, and to what extent did that get at the supervisory or leadership qualities that the MAC was looking for?
Well, there's a written assessment in 2017. There's a ranking by the supervisors where they specifically rank and talk about their abilities to perform the issues, where the supervisor writes comments, and that's where we get to the Roediger comment.
That's the process, but what are the criteria that are applied in that first stage?
I don't recall off the top of my head what the specific criteria testing in 2017 were, because it changes based on the different years. And I can find that in the record during the break in terms of what the specific reference in the record is. The third point I want to make about the no basis in fact is that there's no contemporaneous documents evidencing what the decision was made upon. There's no specific notes. In 2017, there's some notes from the chief's interviews, but there's nothing in the record demonstrating that that was relied upon in making the decision. And two, there's nothing from the earlier promotion processes at all in this chief's interview that takes place behind closed doors. And to your honor's question, there's nothing about what the criteria is or used during that chief's interview. It's a subjective, entirely subjective analysis during the chief's interview. And that's where the Meads case comes in, which the district court decided, fell against Mr. Wingate. And what we're not arguing that the subjective nature of the ultimate decision is alone sufficient to create an inference of pretext. We're arguing that you have to view the evidence in totality. And that was one of the issues that the district court erred in, is that the district court tried to piece out each type of evidence and say, is that alone sufficient to raise an inference of pretext? No, you have to view it in combination. And that's what the Meads court does, is it says the subjective nature of the decision plays a part and is part of the overall picture of what happens here. And when the decision is made entirely subjectively, the ultimate decision, which respondent doesn't contest, that ultimate decision about who is promoted, they say the testing scores play no part in that. And so they can't contend that the scores play a part in the ultimate decision. It's entirely subjective based on the chief's interview's feelings about how the interview went. So that's dealing with the issue about no basis in fact. The second part is, what's the evidence that puts forth enough evidence to cause a reasonable juror to believe that an improper motive more likely than not motivated the retaliation? This is where we get to the patterns of the decisions. And this is what's different about the Osland decision, which is one of the big decisions that respondent relies upon. In Osland, it was one promotion decision, and Mr. Osland ranked in the middle of after the testing. Here, we have four separate promotion processes over the span of 5 years. In 2012, 2013, and 2014, the top two candidates are promoted. In 2017, Mr. Wingate is number one and is not promoted.
In the prior to 17, though, it's my understanding he was not one of the top two candidates.
He was third in 2012 and 2013 and sixth in 2014.
Okay. You would agree that the MAC doesn't have an obligation to promote the top candidate after the first round?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. That's correct. They don't have an obligation to do it. What we're saying is, does the pattern of their decision-making process at least raise an inference that his protected conduct may have played a role? And that pattern over the span of four separate promotion processes establishes that. Then in 2012 and 2013, when Mr. Wingate is the top remaining candidate, after the top two are promoted, they eliminate the list and generate a new one. In 2014, and this is one of the minor points that needs highlighting, so Mr. Wingate ranks number six in 2014. That list is kept for 38 months, in effect, 38 months. Whereas the two lists prior to that, where he ranked in the top three, were kept for 13 and 19 months, respectively. Number four, regarding the patterns, in 2017.
Why is that important?
Because they keep a list much longer when Mr. Wingate ranks lower than they do when he ranks higher.
Thank you.
But were there more hirings in that? Were there additional hirings in that period? I mean, are there other reasons why they might have kept the list longer?
There wasn't a hiring. When they generated the list in 2014, they didn't hire somebody till 2016 because of some delays they contend. But the issue is, could they have generated a new list? And yes, they could have at that time, just like they did in the previous years. And that's where we get to the patterns. Is it enough to at least raise an inference when this is all viewed together? And then in 2017, Mr. Wingate not only ranks number one, but he's excluded from consideration after he's not selected. They had never done that in the previous three promotion processes. So not only not selected, he's excluded from any future consideration. Then we get to the second point I want to make on they were motivated by his protected complaints. He is the most qualified at the time. In 2012 and 2013, he was the number one remaining candidate. In 2017, he was the number one overall candidate. That is enough to raise a jury question. And all of this evidence is covered by these comments that are made in 2012, in 2013, in 2017 by his managers talking about things like, should he be promoted? No way. If you need to know why, go do your homework, which occurred mere weeks after one of his complaints about Mr. DeSubiana, and then the negative in nature comment in 2017. I see that my time is run. I'll stop at this point.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Castor. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Joe Weiner on behalf of Respondent Metropolitan Airports Commission. This court should affirm the district court decision for two reasons here. The first is that there is no evidence of causation, and the second is that there is no evidence that the articulated reasons by the chiefs in their interviews is pretext for retaliation.
Counsel, I'm going to challenge you right away here. I have a hard time when I review that performance history not to think that that doesn't support a reasonable inference of causation and pretext. He's getting awards. He's got no disciplinary history. He gets satisfactory grades in every category. He's nine times passed over.
Your Honor, I think this is very much similar, I think, to what judges look at when they're looking for clerks. There are people who are coming in who are all well qualified. There's no doubt that all of these candidates who are out here are well qualified. And Mr. Wingate himself indicated in his testimony that he didn't think that he was more qualified than any of these other individuals,
Let's talk about the man that was talked about here, his colleague, who I'm going to be generous here and say he has a pattern of very strange behavior, and yet he gets promoted.
Your Honor, I think that the MAC had no idea about that behavior at the time that he was promoted. So these things didn't really come out to the folks who were making decisions, Chief Rosno, Deputy Chief Tolsma, who made the decision in 2012. They had no knowledge about anything as it related to Mr. DeSubiana.
And what did they do when they found out?
They disciplined him when they found out about it.
But they didn't demote him, though.
Not at the time, no, Your Honor. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that he's a unionized employee and they have to make decisions based on what they can actually do. If they're going to demote him as part of this, they have to go through a unionized process for that. And they have to look at what the courts have said and what the arbitrators have said about what's going to happen there. So just the fact that Mr. Wingate has good record and as a line officer does not provide support that he would make a good supervisor. In fact, the evidence in the record is that as an FTO, what Mr. Wingate did was directed one of his trainees to taser a bicyclist because there was an argument over something, for which Judge Thunheim ultimately found that Mr. Wingate wasn't entitled to qualified immunity on.
What's the significance in 2017 of the chief's award of merit?
That he was doing an excellent job in his DEA position.
And that was the same year that he was number one on the list?
And that was the same year that he was number one in the at the initial phase of the testing process.
And so, passed over for the eighth and ninth time?
I'm sorry?
And passed over for the eighth and ninth time?
I don't think it's fair to say that this is an eighth and ninth time. There were four processes. I think that we could say that he participated in four processes and wasn't promoted as part of four of those processes. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In each instance where he wasn't promoted, was there an explanation given to him as to why he wasn't promoted?
Yes, he was told about the things that we've put here in the record for the court, that he was too black and white.
Is there any evidence of that in the record other than the deposition testimony?
That they provided that to him?
Yes, that they gave him feedback.
Yes, so there is evidence in the record as it relates to the 2017 process where the chief's notes that are in there, and then Mr. Wingate testified that they talked about that. They had a meeting after the 2017 process. Mr. Wingate also testified that multiple times after each of these things, he went to go talk with the deputy chiefs to ask them why did this not happen here, and they shared that feedback with him. So this was shared with him. It was shared with him contemporaneously.
The two black and white, the need for affirmation, and the not a good supervisor, each time that was relayed to him, I thought there was... I could be wrong. I thought there was a suggestion that that wasn't relayed contemporaneously in the time and was not in the notes.
So in 2012, pardon me, Your Honor, nothing was relayed contemporaneously. There wasn't any issues there. In 2013, after the two black and white, that was relayed contemporaneously to Mr. Wingate. In 2014, he didn't even qualify for the chief's interview. He finished fifth in there. And in that situation, there was a panel interview. There's always a panel interview as part of the initial phase. And during the panel interview, there is someone from an outside law enforcement agency who comes in and participates as part of that. In 2014, the person who came in was Chief McPhee from the Three Rivers Park District. And in the interview that Mr. Wingate had with Chief McPhee, Chief McPhee also said he's too black and white.
And what does that mean when you say, when they say he's too black and white?
For someone who's in a supervisory position, there are some times where you have to be able to see the gray area. And we see this with the bicycle incident with Mr. Wingate.
That was back in 2008. We're talking, you know, he's
But I think
a number of years in a number of different roles, teaching and other things. So I assume they took that into consideration.
Well, they do look at that, and I think it's also, in looking at that, he was black and white.
Is that the only example of being too black and white?
Well, I think it has more to do with how do you respond.
In the record.
And you look at the notes from Chief McPhee in the record. How do you respond to this and to these questions? And the answer is it's either X or it's Y. And sometimes as a supervisor, you need to have some flexibility as it relates to this. The issue, is, in addition, is that there's nothing to say that that's not true. It's been identified by Deputy Chief Tolsma. It was identified by an outside observer as from part of this who had no knowledge of any of this protected activity. So the idea that it's not accurate, I just don't think that the evidence, there's nothing in the evidence in the record to contradict that. I do think that it's important to note that in the promotion process, once someone goes to the chief's interview, everyone starts from zero again. And we do have notes from 2017 about the exact things that Mr. Wingate was questioned on. And
I looked at those notes. I didn't see any reference to him being too black and white in the 2017 notes.
There's no, the rationale in 2017, part of the difficulty with this case, Your Honor, is that there four different promotion processes that Mr. Wingate complains about. In 2013, the issue was he was too black and white. In 2014, the issue was that he was too black and white. By all accounts, he had improved in that area because it wasn't an issue in 2017. The issue in 2017 was that he lacked an understanding of the big picture of the department and the MAC's goals, that he was overly focused on his own performance and unable to demonstrate how he would help employees grow. And when you compare his answers in the interviews to the individuals who were selected, who talked about the fact that there was a jumper situation where he reached out and he was involved with the families and he got involved with setting things up to help that family and help the department make a connection when there was this really scary incident. Or you compare that to the person who was out and thought he was never going to be able to be a police officer again because of a medical injury, and how he's used that to counsel other employees and other officers to meet this position. When you take those things and compare it to Mr. Wingate's answers, it's reasonable. It's not the role of the court to serve as a super personnel department. It's whether there's reasonable basis to state that the rationale given is not true. And quite simply, we're talking about a different skill set than his line officer position, and there's nothing to say that that's not true.
So certainly there's a different skill set involved to be a sergeant than a line officer, but how did he score so high in the first phase if he didn't have those skills?
I think everybody scores high in the first phase.
Well, he was first.
In the 2017, yes, he was first.
And that's what I was referring to.
Okay.
Sorry.
The issue there, I think, is there have been many times where people have been first and they're not the first person selected. There have been times where someone does well on the initial phase, but it is the interaction with those individuals. And one of the things that I think is really important here is that there is no evidence in the record that ties any retaliatory animus whatsoever to any of the decision makers in this case. There's nothing that ties it to Chief Everson. There's nothing that ties it to Deputy Chief Christensen, and nothing that ties it to Deputy Chief Olson. If anything, what we've seen is that they were responsive to him when he brought these complaints. In fact, Deputy Chief Tolsma in 2013, when Wingate first raised this, said, "Thank you for bringing this to our attention. We needed to know about this." So this is all part of the reason why this is important. I think that when we look at this case, compared to, say, something like Osland, the facts are less in Mr. Wingate's favor than those in Osland.
Counsel, do you agree with Mr. Castor's argument that on page 21 of the findings that the court got the burden wrong?
I don't know that the court stated that exactly the way that it should be stated, but I don't think it changed the analysis that happened as it related to the pretext here.
Could you explain that?
Sure. I think when you look at the analysis that the court did as it related to the pretext question, whether this thing was either false, evidence that something was false, which we don't have, or evidence that there was some kind of retaliatory animus or something along those lines, those simply were not there. And I think when you look at those pieces of it, there is no basis to say that the rationale that was given by the chiefs is untrue. And it's very similar, I think, to the Torgerson case, where you had the fire chief in that situation making a decision based on his interviews and ultimately deciding, you know what, the answers that this person gave were not as good as the answers that somebody else gave.
Does the court need to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant?
It does.
Okay. Agree on that?
I agree with that. And I do think that, Your Honor, that the judge, that the district court in reviewing the actual evidence did that. I think that the statement was maybe not the best way to say that, but I do think...
In fact, it was wrong, correct?
I think when you look at the analysis was correct. I think that the evidence was taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Wingate, but I do agree that the statement there was not an accurate statement of what this court needs to do in reviewing that evidence.
Thank you.
I also want to point out that in terms of the pretext here, Mr. Wingate wants the court to look at all the evidence as a whole, and that's true. Yeah, it should. But what the district court did was didn't silo that evidence. It provided the context for that evidence. So when you look at, for example, all these, they're saying that there's a pattern here. We're talking about different decision makers. In 2012, it's Rosenow and Tolsma. In 2013, it's Tolsma, Everson, and Christensen. In 2014, it's none of those individuals because he didn't even make it to a chief's interview. And then in 2017, it's Everson, Christensen, and Olson. It's new people, it's different things every time. So the idea that just because he continues to apply for these positions that he's somehow entitled to them?
Well, I mean, you know, so these people never talk to each other?
Well, I don't think that there's any doubt that they talk to each other. The issue is...
And presumably, I don't know, maybe they're still talking to Roediger. I understand that it's, you know, you're saying we should look at all the evidence and not in a vacuum. And I'm suggesting, you're right, we should do that, and we shouldn't assume that all of these various lieutenants and captains, you know, don't have coffee together and say, oh, by God, you know, look who's coming up again. We still hate him for, you know, ratting out whatever his name is, Duzipagina, you know, 10 years ago. Wasn't that a mess? And, you know, and then we, you know, God, what if that had gotten to the papers yet, da-da-da-da. You know, I have to admit, I am sympathetic to Judge Cleary's point. I have no idea whether all of this indicates he was being discriminated against or not, but I'm not so sure this is enough to not get a trial. I mean, there's a lot, particularly in the last round where he's number one, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, even I thought, well, I guess it's going to happen this time. Explain to me why this, applying the correct standard of law, looking at all the evidence of a whole, why isn't this enough to at least present to the jury for them to decide whether there is a reasonable inference that he was being retaliated against for past conduct, blah, blah, blah?
I think the issue here, Your Honor, is there's a difference between an inference and pure speculation. And what Mr. Wingate is asking the court to engage in is speculation. He had the opportunity to depose all of the decision makers as it relates to this case. He had the opportunity to look through all of the documents that were here. And through all of that...
But there's very little documentation of the reasons that the MAC is giving for the, you know, not promoting him.
Well, but there is the documentation, and it is there.
And, well, as to him being too self-centered. Is there any of that in his performance reviews? I mean, that's something that would, if it existed, would be reflected in his current position. It's not something that would only be evidenced in a supervisory position.
And as Chief Everson noted in his response, that is not necessarily a bad characteristic in a line officer, but it can be a big problem for someone who is a supervisor who wants to make everything about themselves.
It just seems like there really isn't much evidence to support the MAC's position here.
I don't think that there's any evidence that goes the other way, Your Honor. I think that's the issue. The MAC presented its evidence. There are contemporaneous notes from the 2017 process. There are notes from other processes as well, and it's all there, and it's all consistent for the process. I take the
Your Honor's
point.
2017 contemporaneous notes say, too black and white, need for affirmation, not a good... I can't remember what the last one was.
I don't believe that's the 2017, okay. Your Honor. I believe that's that's the 2013, I believe, where he's too black and white. Let me just, I see I'm out of time, if I could just close and say, just because someone might be a good trial lawyer doesn't mean that they would necessarily make a good judge. And it's the same thing that we see here.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that way.
Well, what we have seen is that there is a lot of speculation, but that the evidence here is that there's no causal link to any of the decision makers to the decision to the protected activity, and there's no evidence that the rationale that they have provided is not their accurate take on what had actually occurred and their belief about who was qualified and who wasn't. And for those reasons, the court should affirm the district court's summary judgment ruling.
Thank you very much. Mr. Castor, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I want to make three quick points before I conclude. One, I want to get back to Your Honor's question about where in the record regarding the 2017. It's DI 27. It's Exhibits 27, which is the 2014 analysis, and then Exhibits 68 and 76. So it lays out four categories or criteria that were used: a writing exercise, a report review exercise, a panel interview, and a first-line supervisor potential ranking. And that's really the important one, because the supervisors are giving the candidates potential rankings on the position they're applying for, which is a supervisory position, as well as the panel interview. Now, we don't know all of the questions that were asked because we don't have the documents during that panel interview, but presumably a reasonable inference could infer that the questions they were asking were designed to test the candidates on the position they were applying for. The second point I want to make is, respondent makes a number of points about Mr. Wingate's subjective beliefs about his characteristics in comparison to the other people. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Wingate's subjective beliefs control the day and control the decision. The objective data does, and the objective data proves that Mr. Wingate was in the top three separate times and was number one in 2017 and was not promoted. The third point I want to make is, respondent has pointed to the Torgerson decision as supporting their belief. I'm not sure where they get that understanding of Torgerson. In Torgerson, the plaintiffs ranked in the 40s after the testing, and the candidates who were promoted ranked in the top 10. In direct contradiction here, Mr. Wingate ranked in the top three and was number one in 2017. As well in Torgerson, there was specific criteria for everything that happened during the testing. They were given direct, they were trained on how to do the interviews. They were then given questions in the same order by the same people and then ranked 0, 1 through 10, and those scores were compiled to give the end ranking. And so this case is in direct contradiction to that, where there's no notes, at least prior to 2017. There's no idea of how those rankings were made. And then Mr. Wingate ranks number one in 2017, and he is not yet promoted. The final thing I want to say, and Your Honor's hit on this a couple times, here's what we have. We have a candidate who has worked for respondent for 10 plus years. Every single one of his reviews paints a picture of an exemplary employee who did everything possible that was asked of him. One of his supervisors says, there's abundance of good things to say about you and zero negative things, zero negative things. He worked in specialty assignments. He took an FTO position overseeing other officers. 4 separate times he applied, 3 separate times he ranked in the top 3, and he's not promoted. In contrast, we have an individual who was accused and found to have engaged in repeated sexually offensive behavior against people in the office, of which his supervisors had knowledge. And even after he's warned, he still continues to do it. And not only that, what happens, he's promoted to the exact position.
Well, I mean, that's an argument for him to be fired, not for Wingate to be promoted.
Sure, but it goes to the idea of what the favorable treatment and why Mr. Wingate was filing the complaints that he did, is he felt like Mr. DeSubiano was getting this specialized treatment. And that decision about who gets promoted is behind closed doors. We have very little knowledge of the criteria or what they used. It's entirely subjective. And I want to point the court to one exhibit. It's Exhibit M in DI 29. It's Deputy Chief Olson's notes from 2017. At the very bottom of that page, Mr. Olson writes that Mr. Wingate seems to be narrowly focused on his experience with the DEA. And then there's this word. He says past. He's narrowly focused on his past. And then in 2017, we have a comment by Mr. Wingate's supervisor that talks about his complaints about Mr. DeSubiana that are negative in nature. So his complaints about DeSubiana are negative in nature, and then he's not only not promoted when he's number one, but he's excluded from any future consideration. That evidence, when viewed as a whole, is enough to create a jury question that should have warranted dismissal of defendant's motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Castor. The matter is submitted.